Chapter 22. Spring Homecoming.
Well, that was exciting, Sir Ansel grumbled sarcastically as we rode into sight of the gates of Sevendor. Well, there were no actual gates yet, but the gap in the dike wall had grown a defensible doorway, and I was gratified to see the earthen wall well-manned and sentries alert in the dike tower. Gimbal's mercenary interlopers had been busy enough to keep my men on their toes. We'd been spotted a mile before we arrived, and the men were alert with their weapons even after they had started to recognize me. "You know, it's not really sporting, Mage Lord," Sir Ansel said, shaking his head, "when you just put them all to sleep." "It worked, didn't it?" I asked, "and I don't make war for sport. Now we have nearly 40 sets of armor and weapons, not to mention all of those lovely destriers. Some of them may even be war-worthy. It was so thoughtful of Sire Gimbal to send those to us. I just don't know how we're going to feed them all," I worried. An abundance of war-horses was a good problem to have. There were few prizes in the bounty, but at least a dozen serviceable cavalry horses. The rest would be used to pull the ploughs of the Sevendor peasants Gimbal had tried to raid. Taking the raiding party had been ridiculously simple, after a little preparation. Only about half of them were actual knights. The rest were men-at-arms and professional squires, sellswords looking for easy loot and a bit of adventure. Some were soldiers, and not particularly motivated. They had been sticking to their camps when they weren't patrolling or probing my frontier, and we found them encamped only half-armored, half-drunk, and undisciplined. They waited out the heat of the day in the shade of the trees of a little grove about a mile and a half from Sevendor's frontier, confident their sentries would alert them at need. Of course, that was difficult to do when the sentries had been sent to sleep with a simple spell. That seemed a better route to take than merely slitting their throats. As Gimbal's men had taught me well, a dead knight might add to your glory and renown, but a live one added to your purse. Sir Ansel hadn't been pleased by that, but the rest of my party didn't mind stripping and binding the snoring sentries. Then I tapped the witch sphere for a much larger sleeping spell that covered the entire area. Unlike goblins, there were no magical defenses of note at all. They went out like babies. Either Sire Gimbal had not warned them that they were facing a mage, or they had not given it much thought. The only ones who gave us problems was the patrol that had returned to camp just as we were finishing the bindings on their fellows. They threatened to give us a fight, until I calmly felled a tree with a blast from my hand. Timroth's Lucindiri, more deadly on wood than people. Then they turned over their swords and surrendered when I gave them the opportunity. I now had 45 pledges to pay ransoms in my saddlebags, a dozen of them knights, not to mention a long pack train loaded with loot, delivered virtually to my doorstep. Since these were mercenaries in Gimbal's pay, he would ultimately be responsible for the ransoms, in addition to their fees, if they tried to insist. Plenty of warlords didn't bother to pay mercenaries who got captured. I marked each of their faces with the snowflake of Sevendor until their ransoms were paid, with the warning that such a mark would earn a man a hanging if he was captured in battle with my people. They marched off on foot, humiliated and defeated. They had been captured and paroled, and they could not legally take part in any future engagements against me until their ransoms were paid. Plus, the embarrassment of falling asleep on duty and waking up a prisoner had made them all a little cowed. It was a small price to pay to keep their heads, I reminded them. As easy as it had been, however, I knew that it was a portent of things to come. When your neighbours start hiring mercenaries, even the poor country knight variety, just to piss you off, you have to figure they're serious about their dislike of you. Sir Ansel suggested hanging a few as a warning to others, but I didn't think they merited such a bloodthirsty approach. That sort of gesture was rarely a good idea. A bunch of vengeful families of dishonored petty nobility swearing vendettas against me was a headache I didn't need, no matter how clear the message a gallows would send. It was enough that I was going to be sleeping in my own bed tonight, without ruffians at my door. I'll trade that for glory any day. Besides, I got all the glory I needed when the sentries recognized me, and then the ramparts were filled with militiamen and guards shouting and cheering. The cheering got louder when the long train of horses and baggage appeared,
and Sir Ansel announced that the 20 of professional raiders had been defeated. That sent them into a lusty shout of victory, before they started chanting, "Mage Lord!" Apparently, I had been missed. And then I was overcome, because I realized I was home, not just back where your wife and stuff was staying, but home. It felt good. I was impressed with what had been done to the place while I was away, too. Just looking around the bulwark and related defences told me that the militia had been busy as beavers while they had held the site. The wall itself had been bolstered with close-set columns of stone, I saw, and there were a few scars and repairs that looked like the result of a fresh assault. I asked the gate captain, Ancient Vren, about it, after he had brought me a welcome draught of cider to wash the dust from my throat.
"Oh, that lot out beyond the frontier tried to get in a few times," he dismissed. "They ne'er got over the wall, though, Mage Lord," the old man assured me. "Oh, they hollered they did and tried to launch a few shafts, but there's no way these paltry Riverlands bows can best a Wilderland bow. We wounded a few of them in a couple of minutes of hot work, and after that they kept out of bowshot." That was good to hear. I'd been worried about our defences. I hadn't expected Gimbald to be so openly aggressive, but I was glad we'd been prepared.
"That's because his first two raids didn't work," Ancient Vren explained. "The first one happened 2 nights after you left, Sire Minelan. Tried to come over the wall. So we chased him off and we made the wall higher. Tried to come through the gate the next night. We made the passageway stronger. So then they just ran down anyone who left 7 door this way, but they never made it 1 inch past the gate," he said proudly.
Before I could regale them all with the dire news of the war in the west, I was surprised to see Sir Kay, looking quite official in a new blue riding tunic, gallop to the dike tower at full speed before skidding to a stop on his fine black horse. His usually taciturn face was split with a wide grin that was uncommonly boyish. "While you are pretty enough a sight, Sir Kay, I had hoped that my lady wife was going to greet me." My castellan gave me an uncomfortably knowing look.
"Lady Alia decided to make herself ready to greet you in your chamber. She somehow found that more appropriate than an hour's ride by wain or horse."
"I defer to her judgment," I chuckled. "Yes, I was anxious to see my wife, and apparently she was equally as anxious. But there was the caravan of Bavali refugees to get encamped, which I inquired about before my own selfish desire for news of my wife and child.
They started coming over Cowland's Pass about 3 hours ago," he told me quietly as we rode back toward the castle. "A little footsore, but otherwise hardy. We've been expecting them and had sent a party through Cowland's Pass to guide them away from the Bastador Pass.
I am thankful to hear it," I sighed. I had envisioned some scheme of Gimbald to ambush my people, but he was as imaginative as he was honourable. "How are they faring?"
"Almost half of them will have tents or shacks to move into on the commons, now that the weather is warmer. The others we can lodge in the outer bailey, if need be. And of course there is room for more at the new village," he added proudly, as we came to the nearby site.
I smiled at the sight of the bustling little community that had seemed to grow up like one of the spring wildflowers around it while I had been gone. There were at least 30 small circular homes in a neatly laid-out pattern, each with a few rods of yard in which sheds and lean-tos and the foundations of barns and byres had been built. They weren't particularly sturdy things, but then the climate here was milder. A carefully split tree trunk provided the exterior pillars, supporting beams of birch wands, where thatch was being laid. Bare gardens, recently hacked from the earth, were beginning to sprout beside them. The frames and foundations of 5 large rectangular buildings stood toward the centre of the new village, surrounding the foundations of a much larger building, clearly a future manor house. It was an ambitious project, even grand, and I wondered how much of our fund Sir Kay had invested in it.
"That will be Bovol Hall," he said proudly, as we stopped to survey the scene. 2 stories, with 6 bays and a stable. The site next to that is the Grange, and near to that is the new inn. I believe the Mage Lord said he wanted an inn. This near to the dike tower, it cannot help but prosper. On the other side is the smithy, and across the road next to the Grange is, with Bover's blessing, a new creamery. He sounded like a man possessed of a religious vision. "It is not Bovol,
but it is all that will be left of Bhoval. It's Bhoval enough, I sighed. How are we paying for it? Since the domain owns the fields and the land, we're loaning the money for construction, and the settlers are pledging to repay within a reasonable amount of time. For now, each cot will owe 2 days a week labour to the manor for the next year, in the fields or in work parties, in addition to the day they owe the domain. For that, they get to cut wood from the slopes, harvest thatch from the fens, and receive a shovel, a pail, an axe, and a hammer each. Every third man gets a wheelbarrow. Each cot has 4 rods of croftlands for garden or meadow. Every good wife gets 2 hens and a goose. Every second house gets a goat and the other a sheep. Seed and stock are provided by the manor, as are the ploughs and teams. 3 teams of oxen, 2 of horse. Rent shall be 1/2 ounce of silver a year, with payment in kind or in week work accepted. And there is room for perhaps 12 more cots of this size. More, if we build on that meadow above. Further credit has been extended on individually negotiated terms, should a household wish a cow or other stock. He finished. You have had no complaints about the terms? I asked. Since the additional work week is temporary, the Bhovali are not concerned that they would become bondsmen, he explained. A single day a week owed to the manor was normal for free peasants. More than 2 days, and you were usually considered a villein. And the rents are being offset by additional work the manor pays out for construction labour. As long as you're keeping track of everything, I agreed. How fares Yeoman Rollo in his new station? Sir Kay nodded approvingly. The Mage Lord chose his man wisely. He has directed the construction of his future home with great attention. He has performed admirably in setting the allotments in the fields, with my approval over the domain's share. He has been diligent in keeping his accounts, and does not seek to cheat the villagers. He is the first one at work and the last one to leave the fields or job. He leads the folk by virtue and example, not by demand. I thought he'd do well here. I used Mageside to peer more closely around the village until I located the yeoman. He was overseeing the construction effort, yelling instructions to a team of labourers as they erected the first roof pole on the structure's first floor. He looked determined and committed. He didn't look haunted. That was a good sign. Behind the village, on the long fallow fields, the ploughing season was underway. Teams of oxen and horses pulled the new ploughs I'd purchased through the earth in long, hard-won strips. The shapes of the fields were starting to fill in, and free Bhovali and hired 7 Dori villeins with hoes broke the clods apart. Some were scattering fistfuls of clay to sweeten the soil. Sowing would begin any day now. And what are those? I asked, curious at a line of saplings being planted on the shadier side of the slope. Apples. 2 varieties suggested by Master Ulming. He suggested that these 2 apples will make an ideal cider. Beyond that, pears and 2 types of nuts. It will be years before they are productive, but Master Ulming is hopeful. I could tell by the tone of his voice that he shared that hope ardently. Indeed, he has been adept, if you will excuse the expression, at counselling the people in their plantings. The 7 Dori are somewhat resistant, particularly the gentlemen, but the Bhovali have no traditions to be overturned, and they abide by his counsels religiously. And that building? I asked, pointing to a minor spur of Matten's Helm to the north of the village, where an outcropping of rock limited the usability of the land for much. The building's foundation was round, with 2 small bays. A tiny cottage was being built unobtrusively behind a stand of pines nearby. That is the shrine, Mage Lord, he explained, sounding pleased with himself. It seems that Goodman Tevram was taken with a temple he favoured near Limwell, and felt called by Huin to take holy orders. When he discovered that you had authorised a shrine in the village, he volunteered to be ordained under the plough, and became a land brother to tend it. I didn't remember Tevram very well, save that he had been a ploughman from Malin, and that he had fought ferociously at the breach in the siege, before taking a nasty wound to his leg. He's earnest in his studies. There were some who saw the clergy as an easy job, and took orders to profit. I wanted clergy who worked for the people, not for the gods, or their own aggrandisement. That's what lords were for. Sir Kay shrugged. I am not the best judge of such things. but he knows his letters. He writes tolerably well, and he has studied with a few land brothers. He has heard that there is a land brother, a popular monk named Land Brother Myson, who runs a shrine in a nearby domain, with whom he hopes to study. Should he succeed in taking orders, I have promised him 3 acres and the cottage for his support. That would be a boon, I admitted. One of the problems plaguing our administration of the domain was a lack of trained clergy. Ideally, each village would have at least a monk or a nun in residence to teach the young, administer sacraments, and keep the village's records. See that it happens. Bribe the other land brother to come here and teach him, if you have to. As you wish, Mage Lord. He gave the site of Bovol Hall one last paternal look before turning his horse to follow mine. This was his special project, I could tell. His opportunity to design and build a manor from the dirt up. He didn't have to contend with tradition, history, or someone else's mistakes. Bovol Hall would be his journeyman work in a state administration. The fact that it housed the folk he knew the best only made his dedication more meaningful. And to keep work going when there was an active insurgency nearby. Tell me, those mercenaries, how much trouble were they, actually? They have been harassing our frontier and interdicting traffic, Sir Kay admitted, but they have not prosecuted their attacks any further. Twice we've chased them away with cavalry, but they returned the moment our backs are to them. You captured the lot, Mage Lord? Through base sorcery, not skill at arms, I dismissed, but I captured them and took their ransoms, arms and horses, and gave them pretty snowflake mage marks, and a merry tale to entertain the servant girls in return for their service, I nodded. I doubt that they will continue to bother us. Sir Kay's expression turned serious. Yet their master will. Twice I have received letters from his castellan demanding the return of Brestall, the refund of some of our ransoms, and other nonsense. I responded tersely to the first, and ignored the second. Then those ruffians showed up. I've kept all traffic going through Cowland's Pass to avoid them, but I'm pleased that won't be necessary now. He looked uncomfortable. Mage Lord, the bandits were a minor nuisance, not a real threat. But the way the people responded to the summons. I was surprised. You had some who shirked. He was surprised. Shirked, Mage Lord. Quite the contrary. I feel I should mention that in your absence, the folk of Bovol Hall came to the defense of the dyke 3 times and responded valiantly each time. They arrived in great numbers, within moments of hearing the alarm. They seem almost eager, he said, struggling for the right words, to fight those who would take from them what you have given. Indeed, we had more men report to the wall than we had arms for. That's not a bad problem to have, I chuckled. It's when you call and no one comes that you have problems. And we seem to have just accepted delivery of some 40 sets of arms and armour. And that reminded me of something important. When I had been staying at Wilderhall a few moons ago, the ink barely dry on my patent of nobility while I waited for my fief to be selected, an old baron had taken me under his wing for a few days while he waited on a court ruling. When he learned I was newly ennobled, he'd given me a crash course in what he thought was the most important thing to know about being a noble. After 2 days, I'd learned a lot. For example, don't buy a drink for an old baron unless you want him to talk your ears off. But amongst the self-importance and stupidity, he had occasionally let slip an actual nugget of wisdom. I remember him grabbing my arm and making me look into both eyes, something he insisted upon only when he felt the subject was of a special import. There is no better way to secure a man's loyalty, affection, and adoration than by presenting him arms, he'd said in his smoke-stained voice. Your sons and sons-in-law will rebel and betray you, but a man who bears a sword you put in his hand will be faithful as the dawn. Most of the Bovali had little left in the way of arms and armour. Besides their precious bows, the armories of their former domain had given them some basic quality arms, swords and spears of low quality iron. Siege gear, designed for short-term use in manning the walls. Many of the swords lacked scabbards, and the spears were wrought iron, not steel. While most kept their weapons after their departure, some had to sell what they did have
to keep food on the table in the south, but those mean blades had kept bandits and cutthroats at bay, and kept the Bovali together. The mercenaries' captured armour and weapons were not fancy, but they were leaps and bounds ahead of the cheap swords and simple spears my men now held. And while most lords were shy of common men who knew too much about weapons, I did not think I had to fear a peasant revolt any time soon. Giving the Bovali arms would be the best way to secure their loyalty. It wasn't the way the average lord did business, but I was a mage lord. I was making this up as I went along. Sir Kay, I want you to have Captain Ferrando inventory and sort the new arms, I ordered, to the end of culling the best for his men who lack proper equipage. The rest I wish to be presented to the folk of Bovall Hall. We should be able to find 24 complete sets there, at least. They can be stored in the manor hall for now, but then have a secure armory built for storage. If the folk closest to the Dyke Tower are armed and ready, it will keep us from wearing out horses from the castle or Brestall Tower every time someone hazards our frontiers. Are you sure that is wise, Mage Lord? He asked in surprise, leaving arms at the disposal of the peasantry like that? Do you really anticipate an uprising, Sir Kay? I asked. The Bovali have proven they can be trusted with arms. They are either loyal or they are not. And it occurs to me, I said, borrowing one of his favourite phrases, that a well-armed, loyal village ready to put 24 men-at-arms on the dyke within minutes of being summoned outweighs the chance of a spontaneous revolt. The Bovali are free men, he reasoned, but would that not make the other yeomanries jealous of the prerogative? Do you see Raylan the Steady's gently men eagerly showing up at the butts? Have you noted the lack of Gurisham folk at militia drills? Sir Kay and Captain Ferrando had been holding weekly volunteer militia practice on the commons since the spring thaw. Basic stuff. Marching in ranks, how to use a spear, and basic swordplay. Few native Sevendori had appeared to better themselves, but the Bovali responded with enthusiasm. I really can't see them protesting overmuch. If the folk of Bovall Hall wish to live here, so close to the frontier, then they should be prepared as we can make them to defend their village, and the vales behind them. We could use those arms to attract trained knights, sire, Sir Kay pointed out. Many a country knight would be happy to swear to you for such a gift. Why hazard to trust Riverland's knights, when I know I can trust my Wilderland's peasants? I asked. That was more politic, and a more convincing argument to Sir Kay than my real reason. Knights may have been military professionals, but they had a tendency to see military value only in their own class. Heavy cavalry was a powerful tool of war, but it wasn't the only tool, or even the best tool, as Sire Sigalan had reminded me. As valiant as Sir Kay and Ronsil were, 100 Bovali peasants, who knew how to fight, would be worth far more to Sevendor than a few professional knights. Sir Kay realized I wasn't prepared to compromise on the issue. It shall be done, Mage Lord. Yeoman Rollo has called for the first hall moot on the manor in a few days, after the conclusion of the ploughing season. I shall make a point of including it on their business. I had planned to distribute some coin around as a reward for their service, but providing them arms taken from their foes would be less burdensome on our treasury, he added grimly. In regards to that, I have some relief, I mentioned. One of the great things about being the head of the new arcane orders, I'm bribable as hell. I didn't even know the half of it until Sir Rondal and Bannermore each told me they'd taken coin to help secure my influence. Within my baggage is a chest with no less than 400 ounces of gold and another 600 of silver, plus sundry gifts of various values. How badly in debt are we? Through careful planning and management, sire, I have kept us technically profitable, he said in a low voice, but I confess to feeling relief at the news. I was going to suggest perhaps we seek a loan from the Temple of Ifnia. I'm glad that's not necessary. We were walking through Gurisham's district now, and I watched with interest as the new ploughs turned the dark brown soil. I'd like to think that the peasant seemed happier somehow, but if you're trying to turn an ox-pulled plough, it doesn't really matter who your lord is or how wealthy he was. Life was far from grand.
But if you did so with a full belly and little fear for your life, virtue and property, that had to be better, didn't it? As if to answer my question, a few of the Gorisham ploughmen took notice of Sir Kay and me as we rode by and waved or bowed. I swear to Huin, there were smiles on their faces. There is one other matter I wish to address with you in private, before you are lured away by your lady, Sir Kay said uncomfortably. The expression on his face took me by surprise. I'm used to Kay being taciturn and nonplussed, and he looked agitated and anxious. What? I demanded, thinking he was concealing something serious. My lord, I have been experiencing certain strangenesses for the last few weeks. Unusual occurrences. Things I can't explain. I awoke in my chamber the night before last to find every taper in the room ablaze, when I know I snuffed them before retiring. My shaving water was hot, but I had to break the ice in the ewer to pour it. I was reproving a gang of gentlemen in the great hall, and banged my fist on the mage lord's table, and broke it asunder. And, well, many more things that I can only associate with magic, he said, whispering the word. He sounded gravely concerned. I could appreciate that. I could still remember the shock I felt the day I realized I had some talent. I'm starting to understand that the snowstone had an effect on such things, I reasoned gently, trying to calm him. It's possible that your proximity to it has allowed a little latent talent in you to show through. In truth, most people likely have a dash of it, but it rises to sight only rarely. Living in a castle of snowstone is probably making everyone who has more than a lick of talent to feel it. That might become a problem, I suppose. But we can teach you a few helpful tricks to deal with it, to control it a little, perhaps. Am I to be a mage, then, my lord? He asked, looking pale. Clearly the prospect did not please him. I smiled at his discomfort, despite myself. It was rare that I'd seen Sir Kay display much emotion at all, much less dread. Would that be so bad? No, even if you're displaying some signs of talent, that doesn't mean you have enough to work even rudimentary spells. And some people just aren't capable of the kinds of things you have to learn first. No offense, but learning magic is very hard work. But now that the bans have been lifted, there is no more stigma attached to it. You don't have to worry about the censorate tracking you down. That's comforting, Mage Lord, he said unconvincingly. What I was more concerned with was not the legal or social cost, but the practical one. I am unused to things happening around me for no explicable reason. I find it discomforting. You'll get used to it, I soothed, but you'll also grow to control it. Most people in your position either successfully repress or ignore their smattering of talent, or figure some way to express it. Most people who manifest talent like this end up discovering one or two particular things they can do with it, like ploughing a furrow perfectly straight every time, or being able to douse for water, or always knowing which way north is. Sometimes it's quite useful, other times it can be pretty useless, and for some people, their talent can wax and wane like the moon, coming as one thing one day, and then something completely different the next. That sounds ghastly, Sir Kay said. It might have been my imagination, but I thought he was trembling. We'll work on it. You, that young knight Festeran, and whoever else needs the help, that's what mage lords are for. From a research perspective, it's quite the opportunity. Few magi have studied sports, as they're called, perhaps a few witch hunters in the censorate, but most researchers pursue more grandiose subjects. You may wish to include your lady wife in that list, Mage Lord, he said quietly. Lady Alia has had a number of disturbing incidents since you have been gone. None have caused injury or damage, so far, but her maid slipped on ice that appeared suddenly on her stairs, for instance, and your child's cradle has been known to rock itself while she sleeps nearby. Perhaps she, too, has a touch more of this talent than you suspect, Mage Lord. My mouth went dry. Alia is a wonderful woman, but she doesn't really have the temperament to be a good mage. It requires a lot of emotional control, something Sir Kay had in wane loads, and enough of an intellect to master some pretty sophisticated concepts.
Alia is not stupid. She reads and knows her sums, but that was about it. Alia had never read a book for pleasure before she met me, and I'd rarely ever seen Sir Kay in the company of a book that was not related to the estate's accounts. If both of them were being plagued by rogue talent, this could be difficult. And that begged the question. "What about the baby?" I whispered. "Is Manalion..." "I am not the best judge of such things, Mage Lord, but the lad doesn't seem to be doing anything untoward. A perfectly happy, healthy babe, by all accounts."
"That's a relief,"
I admitted, exhaling. "It's rare that talent manifests before puberty, but it can happen. Still, Lady Alia is concerned. She fretted while you were away. In truth, I welcomed the skirmishers on our frontier as a distraction. It kept her from brooding overmuch. And Yeoman Sagal's wife, Goody Ella, is near to term, which has distracted her. But something tells me the tonic Lady Alia needs most is her spouse in sight."
"I could use a slug of that myself," I chuckled.
"I can't believe it's only been a few..."
"Sweet briggers, knobby knees, Sir Kay. Where the hells did that come from?"
I asked, aghast. The fields of Sevendor village were completely ploughed and planted, with the first sprouts already leaping out of the ground. Maize, I could tell, and some bean seedlings, and fields of barley and wheat were already growing. There was not a plough in sight, although there were plenty of neatly laid out furrows being hoed.
"I'm astonished," I said, immensely pleased.
The fields of our neighbouring domains we'd passed through on the way back from Sendaria Port were just beginning to be ploughed, much less planted. If Olmec had been able to do this without a witchstone, I could just imagine what he could do with one. I just hoped we had the granary space. As we rounded the curve in the road and the next plot of fields became visible on our right, my throat choked up. Where barren fields and scrublands had greeted me on my initial trip, now it was a carpet of green that escorted me all the way to my door. Master Olmeg had left few fields fallow. Nearly all were planted with something, even if I didn't recognize what they were. My mind started to count up the potential yields.
"We can always build more granaries,"
I finally managed. Sir Kay was pleased, as if he'd grown it all himself.
"Just wait. You haven't even seen the impressive part yet."
A moment later I realized to what he had been referring so mysteriously. We topped a slight rise, the first place where you could really see down into Sevendor Vale from the road. That's when I realized something wasn't quite the way I left it. For instance, just before we came to Sevendor Village, when the brown dirt of the road turned white with the residue of snowstone, there was now a long earthen embankment off to our right, behind which stretched the mill pond I had envisioned but didn't think I'd see until Manalion was talking. The pale white dirt of the massive structure was already starting to sprout grass seedlings, and there were some rough spots, but otherwise it seemed to be quite settled. The pond was by no means filled, but there was a respectable amount of grey, muddy water in the bottom already.
"How?"
"Master Olmeg, Mage Lord," explained Sir Kay smugly, with some help from a few work details, but it was mostly his design and his spellwork. He persuaded Sir Tyndall to use his witchstone to fill the spaces with earth, but that took only a few days, and while the young knight mage was working with his earthen spells, he went ahead and ploughed up around 40 acres of fields. It's slightly larger than you envisioned, my lord, but perhaps more cunningly designed."
"Damn right it is," I said, shaking my head in wonder.
This surpassed my wildest expectations. I could almost feel the hundreds of items on the list shift as the prospect of a mill, irrigation, and plentiful water supply opened up new opportunities. Olmeg truly was a master at his craft. "Where is he now?"
"He's doing some work on a project over in Brestall today. I can summon him if you wish.
Just have him attend me tonight at supper. I wish to hear all about his work.
This is amazing."
"I had no idea magic was capable of this," he agreed, shaking his own head.
"Mage Lord, the crops virtually threw themselves out of the ground. Master Olmeg found an underground spring and diverted it to feed the pond, and he captured most of last week's rains along with the melting snow from the slopes. The additional water has allowed far better irrigation, and now we have cleaner, better water for Sevendor Village, too. I never would have had the wit to see it, my lord, but a dam was the wisest idea you've had.
I won't argue that, I sighed happily. I can't wait to tour it, and all the fields.
Sir Kay, I feel like I've been away for a year, not less than a moon.
Might I ask how your councils went, and how the war goes?
The councils went better than the war is going, I admitted. The Magi can at least pretend to be organized now. But the war... Keep this quiet. But the dead god is using dragons in force now. 5 castles or cities have been razed from the air, killing thousands in Gilmora and demoralizing the rest of the Western Riverlands. The Duke and local lords are scrambling, but recall that Gilmora is thrice as populated or more as the Wilderlands were. We can expect yet more refugees from there, and if he presses the offensive this summer, the dead god could be in Darkfaller or even Barrowbell by next equinox. I saw Kay look grim. The famous Darkfaller castle was famed across the duchies for its security, and Barrowbell was a major trade city vital to Alshar and the cottonlands of Gilmora. What of the war magi? He asked, hopefully. They have been deployed in force, I promised, without elaborating, but there are limits to what they can do. You weren't at Timberwatch, where we faced a dragon for the first time. My mightiest war mage was able to but wound it, and perished in the attempt. Even as we learn how to use our stones more effectively, we're still very new at this. That doesn't mean we won't try, but I'm not as hopeful as I'd like to be, I said, as tactfully as possible. I understand, Mage Lord. Let us discuss happier things. The details of daily business can wait, I suppose, until you have had time to refresh yourself and greet your lady wife, who is most anxious to see you. But the bare bones of the news is this. 3 weddings are scheduled next market day, when a priestess of Ishii is supposed to arrive to conduct the ceremonies. 2 are among villains, so the manor collected their merchet fees ahead of time. There were 4 babies born in your absence, and 1 that may be birthed before you reach your chamber. I have paid out name day gifts to each family, as tradition dictates, 1/2 ounce of silver for the villein and 1 ounce for freemen. Lefmin the Lucky died in your absence, and his estate is being assessed. He was a native Sevendori freeholder on the Northridge who married a Bovali girl, Fala, Goodman Heroes of Winnercore's eldest daughter. Perhaps not the prettiest thing in the Vale, but very spirited. I remembered the girl, about 16 and shapely enough, but with buck teeth like a mule and almost no chin to speak of. Was there foul play? I asked hesitantly. I really didn't want to hang a woman for murder. Not unless you find her virtue as a lethal weapon, Sir Kay said, chuckling wryly. Lefmin expired while making love to his young wife. For the 3rd time in a day. Oh, I guess he really was lucky. And she is quite distraught about losing her husband during her maiden moon. It was also one of the more promising unions between our peoples. But since he was a freeholder, it turns out that the young widow is the lucky one. She inherits his 20 acres and his cot, as well as his rights. She could have a new husband by autumn if she can pull herself together. A man can look past even teeth like hers for the chance at such a prosperous holding. And there will be plenty of suitors, I'm certain. Her lustiness has certainly been proven, if not her fertility, although I might be hesitant, knowing how her past husband died. Sir Kay looked at me appraisingly. You, my lord? He asked quietly. I reconsidered. They were only teeth, and if her late husband was pleased enough to seduce her thrice a day... No, you're right. I'd see it as a challenge, I sighed. The only thing worse than knowing yourself that well is having people around you who know you even better. One of Sir Kay's more annoying habits. And lastly, he said, as we started down the slope into the valley, surrounded by the lush and fragrant aroma from overturned soil and thousands of growing things, I received word yesterday that our accommodations and reservations have been confirmed. I hope my lord doesn't mind, but I told them that our party would number at least 50, if not slightly more, and 1/3 of that on horseback. What are you talking about, Sir Kay? I asked, shaking my head. Why, the Chepstow Spring Fair in Sandaria, of course, he said, eyes opened wide in surprise.
Has the Mage Lord forgotten? Damn, I had. Yet one more reason why having Sir Kay around was convenient. He remembered things I forgot. I trust you will make all of the necessary preparations, I said worriedly. I hoped so, because I sure didn't want to do it. Already underway, my lord, he nodded smugly. Ah, I see the next party of Bovale descending from the pass. They'll arrive just behind us, I think. He was right. A score of footsore refugees were clearing the trees half a mile ahead. They stopped and looked around in wonder. From that vantage point, they could see the entire valley for the first time. The vibrant greens and rich smells must have been a welcome experience after almost a year without station. This was their new home. I hoped they liked it. I glanced up at the tower over the castle ahead. The summit was bare. There was no mage light, as there was no mage in residence at the moment, and that just wouldn't do. I summoned a tendril of power, and a moment of concentration later, a flash of green heralded the appearance of a big, fat, green mage light. Daddy was home. Sir Kay nodded. Impressive, my lord. Over quite a distance, too. I've been practicing, I said a little proudly. The snowstone helps. I confess I missed seeing the green, Sir Kay admitted. Certainly Sir Tyndall did his best as temporary mage lord during the crisis, but he pouted when I would not let him go chasing after the raiders. When you were gone, the veil felt empty somehow, sire. I never thought I would have grown so used to your magic, but if you have a bit of talent, I might be able to teach you a few small cantrips like mage sight and mage lights. I offered useful things and quite easy once you know how. I stopped. A horseman was approaching from the other direction. While we'd passed four or five gangs of peasants trudging from field to field, there hadn't been any horses. I tensed. Perhaps it was just a messenger. The horse was a grey gelding I remembered from the stable, and the rider was swathed in a satiny white cloak that flashed brilliantly in the morning sunshine. When the horseman reined to a halt, sorry, horsewoman, as her hood fell to her shoulders and a cascade of hair spilled from under a carefully constructed braid, now ruined by the ride, my wife's beautiful eyes shone out at me for the first time in weeks. Then my heart chilled. Why had she ridden out like that, when I'd be home in less than an hour? It could have been any reason, but of course my mind went to the very worst. Menalion? I asked, choked up. The baby's fine, Alia assured me, as she swung expertly from the saddle. She'd been practicing, too. I just couldn't wait. When I got word you would cross the frontier, I... She stopped talking, because her mouth was suddenly full of my mouth. Gods! I had missed her more than I knew. After travelling, council, politics, and war, my heart and my head wanted nothing more than to rule this little land with my wife and be left alone. I kissed her as passionately as I could. She looked better than she had when I'd left. Much of the winter pallor we'd all acquired had left her. Her skin was bright, clear, tan and healthy, and her breath was sweet with the taste of biscuits and honey. Shall I continue the escort to the castle, my lord? Sir Kay asked politely. If you don't mind, I agreed, swimming in Alia's eyes like they were cool pools on a hot day. Lady Alia and I have some urgent family business to discuss. It might take a while, and I'd prefer to get started as soon as... Understood, mage lord, Sir Kay agreed. I could hear his grin in his voice. Might I suggest you'll find privacy for your discussion just off the trail? A small meadow just a few dozen yards up, behind that slope. I would point it out directly, but that grove of trees seems to be obscuring all view of it. I'm sure I can find it, I sighed. If not, well, that bush over there appears to be vacant. Alia beamed broadly at the naughty suggestion and took my hand. It was good to be home.